From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, I ask everyone about hobbies, and special guest Katie asks all of us about making the most of the mid-tier city moment. Woo! Okay.
Making the most of the mid-tier magical moments. This is Joey. We also have special guest host, Katie Driscoll.
Hi, I'm Katie.
And of course, as always, executive producer and glottal stopper, Jess Vander.
Hi, this is Jess. Weird intro, but hey, it's my actual voice back. How exciting.
Yeah, no allergies.
No, definite allergies, but...
We do have... a little bit of maintenance or housekeeping from the corrections department.
Oh, tell us.
Turns out our episode on MLMs was controversial.
We saw that coming.
Yeah. There's a lot of attention. We got a lot of emails. Thank you all. A couple of notes. The DeVos family, Betsy DeVos, her family started Amway. We should acknowledge that, I guess. And the other is we had a few notes of people saying not all MLMs are bad. And one that was brought up was a company called Part and Parcel, which is for plus size women to get clothing. I don't know whether it is not all bad, but you can check it out. And that is the corrections department.
Other caveat, we definitely did not say all MLMs are bad, but go listen to our last episode and hear our conversation.
Maybe they are.
Okay, well... Anyway, we're here today and are so excited to have Katie with us because the first thing that we have to talk about are hobbies.
Hobbies.
Oh, actually, speaking of...
You guys want to look at my stamp collection?
I think the vocabulary for that realm of humanity is kind of terrible. Like, hobbies and crafts. Like, you almost have to have a Midwestern accent to say all of these words.
Oh, sister. Hello, brother.
Are you allowed to say that just because you're from New Hampshire?
No, that's Midwest. Oh, Bobby.
Okay. So I say this because I am frequently confronted with trying to find more interesting ways to describe the kinds of things I like to do in my free time, which run the gamut from jewelry making to baking to paper crafts.
Candlestick making.
Honestly, I've done that once in elementary school on some kind of field trip, and it was I didn't really get it. You just dip the wicks into wax. And suffice it to say, many hobbies. But particularly since I have joined the working world and the adult world, I found that when most people ask what you like to do with your free time, they almost expect that that thing is like a thing, right? It is one thing that you devote all of your time to. Like the word hustle, for example, exists because it's like, oh, well, when I'm not working, I'm putting all of my energies into this thing. It's maybe it's a kind of volunteer endeavor. Maybe it's one particular kind of craft that you have skyrocketed into a side business. And that's great. But for someone like me who has a bunch of different things that I like to do and just it's a few different ways of having a creative outlet, I guess what I want to know is, why do I have to turn my hobbies into a hustle?
Do you not like to make money?
How do you feel about money?
Do you like it? Do you like money?
Money, please.
I guess the question more to me is not about that, but it's more about, does that sully why I'm doing the thing? Right? Like, if for me, a hobby is about a creative outlet or doing something just for myself. As soon as I turn it into a business, that then puts another layer of weight and heft into that thing that might not make it a hobby anymore even.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about like, my husband and I talk all the time about like all of these business ideas that we have. And then most of them are related to things that we're obviously really passionate about. And then you start to think about what that future would look like if you actually turned that into a business for yourself. And like, at what point do you lose that passion? And can you really sustain it if you're doing it not because you love it, but because it's like tied to your income and your well-being and all of that?
Can you share Are they secret?
Well, I mean, I have major dreams of one day opening a cheese shop in Richmond, Virginia, because it's really lacking. I mean, we'll talk about that later when we get to the mid-tier city question. But yeah, I'm like really obsessed with cheeses and have like love to explore cheeses from around the world. And there's just like really nowhere to go to get amazing imported cheeses in Richmond, Virginia.
I just need a stinky cheese. I think like part of it is everything in business is measured, right? Like everything is about success, growth, like tracking. How are you doing? Like how many followers do you have that's tracking your art project, whatever it is? And I think the point of hobbies is not success, right? Like inherently it's supposed to, or at least the way that I think about hobbies is about sort of an intrinsic value concept. Like you're saying, it's you're doing something because you love it. And that in and of itself is how you measure whether it is like a good thing or a bad thing. And as soon as you turn it into a hustle or a grind or you know, whatever, cheese entrepreneur, you change the way that you're thinking about that thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess now, even beyond just thinking, associating hustle with a thing that makes money for you, right? Because I think it's more than that. In a way, sometimes when someone's asking you the question of like, so what do you, you know, like, tell me about stuff that you like to do outside of work, they're also looking for maybe to find out how you identify yourself by your extracurriculars in a way. So even if you're not making money off of it, there's still a pressure of, you know, this is a thing that says something about you. And that's still a layer of, you know, beyond intrinsic value, right? That's not necessarily performative, but it does say like, look, I do this because I want you to know that this is a thing that I do.
Yeah. Jess Vander, strategist, glottal stopper, butcher, baker, candlestick maker,
hip hop dancer.
Oh my gosh.
I want to talk about this pressure that you have mentioned, which is, I think is like a real thing. Like I think about today, there's this pressure that you have some really amazing, whether it is just like a really deep hobby that you're super passionate about, or whether it's like a side hustle where you're literally like trying to create a business out of it. And like, some people just don't want to have like one hobby that you're putting all of your energy into. What if you want to be someone who's just like dabbling in all of these different things? And then when someone asks you like, what's your side hustle? You're like, well, I don't have a side hustle. I have like a million things that I kind of do every once in a while that I really like.
Yeah, exactly. For example, my most recent endeavor is this sock project that I'm working on. And it is totally, I know.
Darner.
Is this where you stitch like salt and pepper?
Whoa. You can't share all of the secrets, but yeah, sort of. It's okay. It's just this thing where I'm embroidering socks and it's really exciting to me because I'm like, ooh, what a cool thing. I just want to test this out. And then I get to wear my creations and I don't usually do fashion related hobbies or crafts, I guess.
Hobbies.
But I would hate, honestly, in a way, like I would hate for someone to be like, oh, what, like, what does Jess do? Jess like embroider socks for fun. That like, I don't want that to be the thing that I'm associated with.
I want it to be the thing that you're associated with. And I'm now on a mission to make
just
sure
spread
that
gospel.
Everybody knows it'll be updated on the website by the end of the day.
But that's the thing about what Katie's saying is, you know, for those who don't want who aren't maybe singularly focused on something, what then?
Yeah. I mean, I've never felt like I have a hobby. I don't think I have one. I'm always jealous of people that have hobbies, not for like the identity politics aspect of it that you're talking about, which I think is real. Like we're in sort of this moment of identity politics and everyone is like a slashy or a multi-hyphenate or like, you know, whatever the, like the term du saison to say,
rock
like how
star,
cool you
slash,
are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But like, I've always been sort of jealous that I don't have something that like tickles me in that way. And I think some of it is like my attention span, sadly, like, but there's not anything that I can think of for a long time that I've like poured myself into. The last thing that I probably did the most of was writing. Like when I had a creative project on the side, like when we were in grad school, that was probably the last time that I had something that would sort of equate at least closely enough to a hobby. But now work is basically my hobby.
But I think there's an interesting dynamic too between like a hobby and passion. Mm-hmm. And like you're saying you don't have a hobby, but I think of you as an incredibly passionate person. And like those two things are different. Like it's important to be passionate, but like how important is it to have that like one hobby that like ties to your identity and sometimes pigeonholes you? Like I feel like I've now shot myself in the foot on this podcast, but for many years people just like knew me as that girl who was really obsessed with cheese. And I was like, but I'm so much more,
I'm more
than that.
Cheese. I'm more.
Don't talk to me about cultures. Yeah, I think like part of it is I think that the, to your point, about it's about seeing people's passion. I think that is part of what is compelling and why other people are like chasing these things. And you get into this like grind culture or hustle culture or whatever that Jess is sort of talking about, I think is part of it is just to like paint yourself as an interesting person, as like one of the passionate ones. Because most of these hustles and grinds that we hear people talk about, like they're not like turning into, you know, multi-million dollar corporation, like, you know, massively successful endeavors. They're like things that people do for a while, try to make something out of it and maybe like make a little bit of money or get some satisfaction out of it. But it really isn't like, you know, people aren't shifting their careers for the most part into their hobbies. And so I think I like the idea of separating the way that you're evaluating those things, because it does. As soon as you make something a job, you're not playing anymore, right?
Yeah, and I guess maybe that's the thing about hobbies versus hustles, is maybe to me I associate hustle with not only wanting people wanting to see your passion, but wanting to be able to remember it. And it's maybe that it's easier to remember if there's this one quirky thing that person is obsessed about, and there's a lot that you can see around it. It's like easier to imagine, kind of even in the way that some, you know, somebody's job title, when it's something really specific and known, like actor or doctor, right? Or things that end in T-O-R, I guess, that it's something really easy for people to understand and wrap their heads around. And so if you have a hustle that's really specific, other people can be like, oh, I got it. You're the cheese person. Oh, you're the sock embroidery person, yeah. Right? Whereas if you're the kind of person who likes to keep a lot of hobbies, maybe that's just because your passion, or at least in my selfish case, my passions are a lot about just making stuff and like doing something with my hands. And that isn't to say also that, you know, I think hobbies are really tied to the tangible and to the point that you were making, Joey, really about, you know, I don't have hobbies. That doesn't, again, mean that you don't like stuff or like doing things.
Well, I mean, I do. I guess I have side projects that I go, like, I have a project for a while.
You wrote
right?
a book, for goodness sake.
Well, yeah, like the book, this podcast that we're currently like talking on, it is a side project. The documentary, like the tech cards that we did, like all of those things, I guess, are side projects. Maybe that's my thing, is getting into something for a little while, seeing how it goes, and then finding a new side project to like work on and try and like get to some end state and be like, okay, did that.
Yeah.
Check the box.
And maybe after all of this, it just feels like whatever brings you joy, just do that thing. And if you want to make money out of it, then that's cool. And if you want to share it with the world or you don't, that's cool. Or if you want to do 15 things that all are very different, that's also cool.
Marie Kondo did it. She turned her hobby of organizing things,
honestly,
into her passion.
True. Well,
it sparked her joy.
I feel like, yes, that's she. What an interesting test case, because that's a serious hustle, but it's all about joy. We'll have to talk to you, Miss Kondo.
Well, get a hobby, or get a job, or get a job that's a hobby, or get a jobby.
Thanks, Joey.
And we're back, and now a word from the cheese lady, Katie.
Honestly, let's not do that to her.
No, we must
We must abstain.
It's okay. I really love cheese. I get it. Okay. So I've already brought this up, but I live in Richmond and I moved to Richmond about a year ago with my husband from after living in San Francisco for 5 years and then Amsterdam for 2.5 years. And I also spend a ton of time in New York for work. And at the moment we are loving being in Richmond and like, you know, there's this bigger kind of movement that's happening where a lot of people are moving from these larger like top tier cities like New York and San Francisco and LA to smaller mid-tier cities that are more affordable and have, you know, better cost of living and way of life and things like that. And we're loving it and loving taking advantage of all of those amazing things of being in a mid-tier city. But there's constantly something in me that is just feeling slightly unsatisfied from being in this city that just doesn't have some of those things that I got so used to over all of those years of living in SF and Amsterdam. And so my question is, how can mid-tier cities rise to the occasion?
So first, let's address mid-tier, because that's a term we're using because there's not really a good definition to tier cities. One of the ones I remembered after we talked this morning was how late stores are open is like one example of like, what can you get at like 11 p.m. and like how many stores are open is like one example of how they measure like the tiers of city. But I think generally for us, we're just talking about like size, like population, right? Like,
and on the open late thing, the relationship is the later the thing is open, the upper the tier of the city.
Yeah.
And that's how they define it?
That's one definition I saw. So because I did a talk earlier this year and I was like trying to understand like what the working definition of second tier, tier two, tier three, mid tier. I like mid tier because it's like, how many tiers are there? I don't know.
You're in the middle.
Yeah.
Jury's out.
Yeah. I mean, there are some other things where they're saying like the only what they would consider international cities in the United States are like LA, San Francisco, and New York. And like
maybe
all
Miami.
All of that gets blurry too. I mean, Miami, arguably, like people from South America have told me that Miami is the capital of South America, which is like a bizarre concept to
too
me.
Too far away from South
because
America.
Because all of the banking in South America happens in Miami.
But I guess other than not being able to get a late night burrito in a certain part of this, you know, city in
the
United States.
That is like a huge part of it to me.
But San Francisco, you can't even get a late night burrito.
Oh my gosh, there's so many amazing late night foods in San Francisco. The pupusas in the Mission.
Ooh.
Oh my gosh, you guys, 3 a.m. pupusas is the best thing ever. But
what is Richmond missing, I guess, other than that late night?
Yeah, I mean, it's missing a lot of things. I think food in general is a huge piece of it, and food and accessibility, which you're tapping into with late night food. So good food, which Richmond does have good food. Like we were just, Bon Appetit just wrote a piece that was like, Richmond is the next big food city. And I read it and I was like, yeah, these restaurants are really good. But like, those are like the 5 restaurants that you listed, like are good restaurants. Yeah,
that's all of them. That is an exhaustive list.
Yeah. And so I think there's one piece of it, which like there is so much growth and there's a lot of growing arts and festivals and culture that's popping up. But then sometimes I still go to those events and it's also the people that you're surrounded by. Maybe they don't feel as like in tune with the culture or I don't know. I think that there's a lot of things that go into it. Other things I've been thinking about are like just like bike lanes or thinking through transportation in general. Mm-hmm. Richmond just did like a revamp of the bus system. And it was like a huge deal because everyone who's traditionally been in Richmond had a tax increase to pay for the buses. And they were mad because everyone has cars, so they don't need buses. And I think that's something that's happened across other cities too.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, in doing that talk, I was investigating like what types of innovation is happening in other cities. And what's interesting is that a lot of second tier, mid tier, however we want to define it, cities are becoming innovation hubs because their size and stature is like in sort of a Goldilocks zone where they're large enough to have big enough funding to do interesting things, but small enough to be able to implement those things. And so Columbus is one really interesting example where they got a federal grant. They got a federal grant for $40 million around this like big smart city grant that the federal government did. And part of the reason they got it is because they'd already matched $10 million from the private sector to come into a fund. And within 2 years after that, they had got the fund through private investment up to $500 million. And so they're trying to do these interesting things because Columbus is like, it's the
ultimate test case city.
Yeah, it has like tons of Fortune 500 businesses. It has a bunch of schools and universities. Ohio State University is there. And so they're trying to change all.
Sorry, had to do it. Go blue.
There's all these like confluence of things coming together. But the other part of it too is that you're increasingly seeing both from rural and suburban areas a magnetism in towards city centers, but you're also seeing from tier one, in quotes, whatever that means, cities push towards second tier cities. And there are a lot of factors that seem, you know, being closer to home, which is why you guys moved to Richmond, but then also lifestyle, right? Like New York, living in New York, LA, and San Francisco is difficult, right? Like there is, it's busy, it's expensive, it's crowded. Like all of the things, like the energy and excitement that you're talking about, also, you know, while exciting at first, can become a bit of a burden. And so, yeah, and so people are going to these places like Austin, Columbus, Memphis. Even Birmingham, Alabama, apparently is having a boom in art, in like the art scene there, partially because of, I think, a school that's there. But there are a lot of these places that are like popping up that pushing like the outward parts of the suburbs or exurbs in towards the city center is starting to create some of that like energy that creates like friction that starts to make interesting things happen, I think.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to think of the moment we're in. It's like, it's this chicken or egg situation, which is like, you can put really amazing restaurants in a place, but does that make the people who live in that place foodies? No. So then you have to like put the good restaurants to attract the foodies so that you can have a conversation with your friends about the food that you love and things like that. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is like park culture. And in San Francisco and Amsterdam, people used to go hang out in parks. And that was just like what you do over the weekend. I'm sure it happens here in New York as well. And it was like my favorite thing to do every weekend. And I live near a lot of really amazing parks in Richmond and they are dead. It doesn't matter how beautiful the day is. Like maybe there's someone like walking their dog, but like no one's hanging out in the parks. And so like, how do you change those behaviors? And like, what does it take? Does it take those new people coming to the place that already have those behaviors and bringing those behaviors to the place? Or is there something, is it a responsibility of the city to kind of create, you know, the opportunities for that?
Yeah, I mean, I know at least in New York, it's, you get people to go to parks because they're otherwise starved of green space.
Yeah.
So they're really excited to go, you know, bring their dog to the one place the dog can run around, or another park that isn't totally crowded by tourists.
I guess if you have a backyard, you don't really need a park.
Yeah, I mean, I think like in Richmond, there, like the Belle Isle is sort of like a park spot that everyone goes to, but it is like sort of off the beaten path and you have to like get there to see that there are other people out and in it. But I think like, you know, there are a lot of drivers that happen, like youth, like the amount of young people that you have in a city starts to create change, right? Like inherently young people are looking for like novelty and change and want to do things differently. Like art culture often is like one of the drivers. I think Richmond is interesting for this reason because VCU has such like a huge art program. And then like, you know, diversity is another factor. And again, like that energy of like putting people together, close together, and hopefully that those people are different is where you start to get like interesting tensions in culture. And I think, you know, one of the big problems that has come out of the way that second tier cities popped up was the suburban culture and sort of you know, like redlining of racial groups into different neighborhoods, different communities and whatever. And the promise of bringing people back into city centers is that you are going to have more diversity and having interactions across different communities. And I think, you know, Richmond is still trying to yeah. push towards that, but that's been a huge problem in Richmond and a lot of, I mean, we can say southern cities, but I think it's a problem everywhere. And you need, like, that's where the energy comes from. Like, even in talking about your food scene in Richmond, like, the question is, like, what are the types of restaurants that are being, like, lauded? Like, you know, like, there is a Vietnamese community in Richmond, and there are, like, some pho spots that are big, but they're, like, outside of the city. They're not, like, in the center, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's this book that Trevor, another strategist here, recommended to me called Stephen Johnson's Emergence. And there's a whole portion of the book that surrounds sidewalks and how important they are yes. for creating those diverse and sort of chance happenstances, right? Because in a park, the thing that you were saying almost is, oh, if everybody has their own backyard, then they don't need to go to the park. But if the park is the place that everyone crosses paths, that's what makes for a vibrant city culture, right? Is that path crossing.
Yeah.
And so it very well may be that cities that are driving cities, that's something that we're thinking a lot about here. And I know on the project that I'm doing, that's a lot we're thinking about. But also just, you know, in general, crossing paths is harder to do when you have either physical or mental barriers between different parts of a city. And I guess what I want to know is if for Richmond, is there hope, not to say that it's really a driving city, but there are certainly sidewalks there. How do we get yeah. Richmond back on top?
Yeah, no. First of all, let me just say I love Richmond. So yeah. It sounds like I'm like giving it crap, but I really do love it. But I think that your point is really interesting about like these moments of intersecting with each other and being open to like creating community. And I think that another really interesting difference between whatever first tier and mid tier, however we're defining these cities, is that because it's so expensive or, you know, overwhelming, however you might want to say that, to live in places like New York or San Francisco, they tend to be more transient. And so the people are coming in and out and there's a bit more openness to like, I'm new and I'm looking for new friends and you're new too. And let's create this community together. Whereas I think in a lot of these like mid-tier cities, a lot of the people who are living there have been there, they've grown up there, they Right. have their groups and they're not, they have their backyard and they know exactly who they're going to invite over for that cookout on 4th of July.
Yeah. Fourth generation of
exactly.
a city type of thing. Yeah.
So even though there are sidewalks and there are festivals and there are moments where that could create connection, I think there's maybe a bit of the people are a bit closed off from that openness of like meeting new people and kind of expanding beyond their own kind of personal bubbles.
Well, yeah, that was like, sort of, I mean, a lot of how the suburbs built up was around like white flight and racial issues. And what the suburbs promised was private spaces where you didn't have to deal with people and you could have your own situation and you could, you know, live your life how you wanted and that you didn't have to be like offended by people of different cultures. And I think that is, you know, like inherently baked into the structure of suburbs, right? And there are places in the world that have suburbs that aren't like this, I'm sure. But I think like when you look at it sort of in the broad picture, that's what it promised. Like, I don't need to smell someone's food, or I don't need to see someone dressing a way I don't like, or I don't need to hear someone talking in a way that offends me. And I think that's what you're seeing also as people come back to the cities that were raised in the suburbs. There is still these moments where someone blows up on Twitter, like, you know, some angry like white lady that is yelling at someone in a public space because she's upset that they're doing something that she, you know, there was this whole thing in DC where a woman like complained to the transit authority about one of the workers eating on the train because she's not allowed to. And the woman's like, you know, like basically just like, mind your business. Like, she just ignored her and the woman blew up. But I think like cities don't promise you your private space. Like, you're going to have someone walking above you in your apartment and you're going to be walking above someone else's apartment and you're going to see people in spaces. And I think that.
And you just makes you feel connected.
Yeah.
Like you're like, maybe I don't know who that person is that lives above me because I've never met my neighbors, but like there's someone out there.
Yeah.
There's someone to serve me a late night pupusa.
Yes.
I don't even know what a pupusa is.
Oh my gosh. The next time we are in San Francisco together, we're going to make a trip.
Yeah, I need to go with you because I'm never able to find food after 9 p.m.
Oh, okay.
We'll put a picture of one of these delicious items in the show notes. It looks kind of like an arepa.
Yeah, I don't really know how to describe it. It's like, it's kind of if you imagined like the mix between like a pancake, like a stuffed pancake, but it's like a corn stuffed pancake. But they put like beans and cheese in it, and then the best part is the salsa and the and like the coleslaw that comes with
okay.
it. And,
oh, ready, ready. It is, a pupusa is a thick cornmeal flatbread from the pipil culture of El Salvador. It is stuffed with one or more of the following ingredients: cheese, usually a viscous cheese like quesillo, that is very common in certain countries. Also chicharrón, which is like the fried pork rind, squash, refried beans, cheese with loroco, they don't explain what that is, unfortunately. The curtido, which that's the spicy cabbage slaw. Is that the thing?
Oh,
the
oh slaw? Yeah. That is the thing.
And tomato salsa. Thank you, Wikipedia. We'll be sharing
one
this
time
later.
My, just a really quick sidebar, my best friend and I had what we called pupusa day, and we basically just walked around the mission. Instead of doing a bar crawl, we did a pupusa crawl. We ate like a million pupusas and then rated them and found the best ones.
I'm also imagining that your best friend is like much smaller than you.
And
you
her name is Katie.
And you carry her in a papoose on your back.
That would have like a papoose.
It is a Native American like baby carrier. It's like a Native American baby Bjorn.
Oh. Next time we do the papoosa crawl.
Yeah. Next time on Critical Nonsense.
Yeah.
Out in field. Okay.
Well, that's it. That's cities. Okay, bye. Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in New York, New York.
Special thanks to our guest host, Katie Driscoll.
Thanks, Katie. And also, no, I can't.
Special thanks to you, executive producer and Spanish accent haver, Jess Vander.
We'd also like to thank actual Spanish accent haver, sound engineer Alex Contel.
We'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for just being around designing.
And stuff. With production help from Sarah Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Ball.
And as always, thanks, Len.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank pupusas.
Even not having had them, I'm really excited to have them.
I'm mostly
now
thanking them for the faces that Katie makes when she's talking about them, because it is just pure delight.
And special thanks to the spicy cabbage that goes on the pupusa, because just reiterating, that's the best part.
I'd like to thank cities for letting me live in them.
Mid-tier, top-tier.
All cities.
Honestly, bottom-tier. Like, good for you.
I wonder what tier Manchester, New Hampshire is. Tier 7?
Ooh.
12?
Sounds low.
15?
How many tiers are there of cities?
I don't know.
I would say 12 is a good place to stop.
Sounds like a good side hustle.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the people on the internet who are coming up with new tiers. I saw them given grades.
Ooh.
Based on the value they provide to the country.
That seems like a recipe for lots of anger.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank hobbies for existing, and maybe also socks for allowing me to embroider them.
And Michaels for selling the thread that allows you to embroider them.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't get this particular thread from Michaels, and the last time I went into a Michaels, there was a lady who was so not nice.
Okay, scratch that. We don't thank Michaels.
No, thank you, Michaels.
So I have a hard time thanking Michaels right now, but like, I know they have so much creative possibility there.
Can I throw a curveball?
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Jason Concepcion for NBA Desktop because they won a Grammy for internet show, and I just freaking love it.
Nice.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Good.
They didn't win a Grammy. They won an Emmy. They didn't make music. This is terrible.
No. Why did we even thank them to begin with? I want to thank parks, too.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to thank dogs pooping in parks.
Okay. What's the name of the Amsterdam park that's like the best park in the world?
Vondelpark. Oh.
Wow.
Vondelful?
You got to get yourself to Vondel Park because that place is paradise.
Mm.
Mostly because it's just
so many
filled with
beautiful
tall,
people.
Tall.
And their babies.
Nordic people smoking weed.
Inspirational.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
Wait.
We have one more thank you.
Okay.
We'd like to thank Connor Driscoll for making it all the way to this point.
And really, you know, honestly, we thought you'd be gone after multiple mentions of slaw and multiple mentions of dogs in parks.
We thought you're Vondelful and we didn't think you'd make it here. But Connor, this one's for you.
Love you.